From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The aftermath of an infrastructure disaster. Hello again, I'm Owen Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most.
A bridge in America just shouldn't fall down.
That was the voice of Minnesota's U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar at the scene of last night's bridge collapse into the Mississippi River. Four people have been confirmed dead, but rescue workers say 20 to 30 more were pinned or trapped in the wreckage of falling steel, concrete, and cars. On To the Point, we'll get an update from the scene of an accident that could be a wake-up call about America's infrastructure. Also today, the House has passed ethics reform. If the Senate goes along, will it end the culture of corruption? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again. Warren Olney back with To the Point. Last night's bridge collapse on a major commuter artery for Minneapolis could be a wake-up call for America's infrastructure. More on that in a moment. Also tonight, with one of its senior members under investigation, will the Senate agree to ethics reforms passed by the House? Is Washington really trying to clean up its act? First, this news update. At least four people were killed, 80 were injured in last night's rush hour disaster. Rescue workers say 20 to 30 more were trapped or pinned in the wreckage. Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback described it this way.
These are horrible images, but within each of those images is a story. That car you see tangled in the wreckage is someone's cousin or brother or husband. And one story after the other unfolds as you look at that. And I think we have to remember that there are some tremendous stories that we'll be hearing. Thank God this wasn't worse.
R.T. Ryback, the mayor of Minneapolis. Nick Coleman is columnist for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. And Nick, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. It's been a long day and evening here.
I'll bet it has. Can you update those numbers? Four people officially killed, 80 injured, 20 or 30 more still trapped?
Yes, that's still what they're saying. I think the reality, the cold and hard reality, is going to be the bodies of people killed in the river still. They haven't been able to get to a number of vehicles because it's just too dangerous where those ones are submerged, and they're concentrating now on a few they can get to. But it's going to take a Herculean effort. They're going to have to lower the river here and bring in heavy equipment and do some very major efforts to actually complete this recovery.
Nick Coleman, again, columnist for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Also with us, Tom Meersman, environmental reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Tom, when they try to lower the river, how do they do it?
Well, the river flows, of course, but the level at which it flows is controlled by various locks and dams that are set up along the river. So the dam that is just south of where the accident occurred can be opened slightly. The gates can be adjusted so that more water flows out and the pool, as they call it, of the river goes down. So the Army Corps of Engineers coordinates all of this. And they did that a little bit this morning already, and they're going to be continuing to do it a little bit more through the day.
Is that giving the divers then better access to the cars where people still might be trapped?
That's the idea, but it gets a little complicated. I just learned that when they dropped it about a foot, they noticed because the water level on the downstream of the bridge was lower now, the water level above the bridge was sort of backing up a little bit. It was increasing the flow, and it was starting to dam up a little bit behind the road that is in the water. So they have to be careful there. They don't want to increase the flow. That would make it more difficult for the divers. But on the other hand, if the overall level can come down some, that will give them access, better access as well. So they're kind of doing it a little bit at a time, letting it stabilize, and trying to provide the safest conditions they can for the search and rescue folks.
Nick Coleman, let me go back to you. There was a crowd of officials there today from the local, state, and federal governments. They're all saying that they will help out. The federal government has agreed to come up, I think, with $5 million initially and considerably more in the near future. Can you update us? So what do you think was the lead from that news conference with all those people?
Well, I think public officials like to have their backs covered, and there was a lot of back covering going on in Magog. My point of view is that what comes next and what recovery efforts, what assistance from the government, various levels of government, isn't as important as how this happened and why this happened. I think there's a sort of a bond between the public and public officials that they are looking out for us and our public safety. No one in the Twin Cities, I can tell you, knew that this was quote-unquote structurally deficient, this bridge, and that it only had a 50% rating and has had for the last couple of years a rating that should have begun talks on replacing or being very careful about watching this bridge. It seems to have been a, you know, you're taking your chances driving across this bridge, and yesterday people paid with their lives, and this is all against the background of both at the federal level and here at the state level, very big public debate going on about what kind of spending we should be or shouldn't be doing on public infrastructure. And this, I believe, is a watershed moment, and it's just sad that people had to pay for their lives to get the public's attention on this.
Apparently, there was collapse at both ends of the bridges. That's said to be somewhat mysterious, and they immediately ruled out the possibility of a terrorist attack. Do you think that'll be revived, that possible theory?
No, and I don't, because I've actually seen a video, a Transportation Department video of the bridge falling, and it seems to fall flat from the middle, I would actually say, in my understanding of it. But I believe if there were any indications of terrorist activity or an act of God, we would know, and I think we'd find it in some ways reassuring. What's really, because then we'd know that it was either out of our hands or someone deliberately did this. The worst possibility, it seems to me, is that it was just due to indifference or irresponsibility or someone not doing their job or not wanting to tackle the hard issues of paying for this. And so this bridge, which was known to have cracks and signs of dangerous fatigue, to be structurally vulnerable and to have only a 50% rating, was very heavily pounded by 140,000 vehicles a day.
Nick Coleman with the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Now we'll come back, talk further with him, with Tom Meersman and others in just a moment on To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Ali back with To The Point, talking once again about the collapse of the 35W Bridge over the Mississippi River near Minneapolis, major commuter artery. It happened at rush hour. There may be as many as 35 or 40 people who died as a result of that crash and many others injured. Rhoda Fukushima is with the St. Paul Pioneer Press. And, Rhoda, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
What can you tell us about the search for missing people and how they're trying to figure out who, in fact, might be in those cars that are still underwater?
Well, they, you know, people were pinned and dying in the wreckage. And this morning, the police chief of Minneapolis said that it had been a dangerous situation with things still falling. And so a lot of these people were saying goodbye to their families by way of the emergency workers. Today, we're seeing dive teams in the water, and they are checking by way of GPS and sonar equipment, and they're also looking at license plates of the cars submerged. They have taken the information from all the cars above water, and now they're in the water.
I don't understand, perhaps our listeners don't either, how the GPS, the Global Positioning Satellite systems, might be helpful. How does that work?
It helps them chart sort of the area down there, so they can get a better feel for what is down there.
So that's really then getting the sense of the what's below the water.
Right, right.
Yeah. Have you been able to talk to people who are in this awful sort of a limbo situation where they don't know whether or not they might have lost a relative or a loved one?
I have not directly, but others here have. One of my colleagues actually this morning early came in with a note saying somebody on her bus knew someone whose wife had talked to her family about 5:30. She works downtown, And that was the last they've heard of her. The daughters keep calling her cell phone, and all it does is kick them back to voicemail.
As we heard the mayor say a moment ago, there are going to be a lot of awful stories as a result of this. There were some miraculous stories, though, too. I understand there was a school bus full of kids, and although it was near the point of collapse, they managed to get the kids out?
Right. In fact, one of our reporters did talk to a 15-year-old who was on that bus, and he described it as they were just about to get off the bridge, and then the bus started to bounce, bounce, bounce. And then he heard a huge boom. And then a staff member, this was the group of kids who were coming back from a field trip, a staff member got to the back of the bus, opened the door, and they started helping the kids out. He figured he was probably had to jump down maybe 4 feet, and he was one of four in his family who were on the bus. He's 15. His little girl cousins were anywhere from 7 to 10 years old. When we talked to him, he was at one of the local hospitals still waiting to be seen. One of his cousins actually had been admitted and released, and he and another cousin were still waiting to get in.
Again, Roto Fukushima with the St. Paul Pioneer Press. The 35W bridge over the Mississippi was completed in 1967. Today, federal and local officials were asked about what we heard earlier, that there was a federal safety rating of 50. Here's the Secretary of Transportation, Mary Peters.
What that rating of 50 means is that the bridge should be repaired, should perhaps be considered for replacement at some point in the future. It was by no means an indication that this bridge was not safe. Had that been the case, MnDOT, Governor Pawlenty would have shut this bridge down immediately.
And here is Governor Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota.
There was no call by anyone that we're aware of that said it should be immediately closed or immediately replaced. It was more of a monitor, inspect, maintain, and potentially replace it in the future.
Again, Nick Coleman is columnist with the Minneapolis Star Tribune. You talked a moment ago about back covering. You said that nobody had known about this report of the 50% rating. Do you think there's going to be a backlash as a result of this?
I think there already is. I'm getting a lot of letters from people who are very angry and very upset about, you know, you can't have the Secretary of Transportation, who, by the way, is a political ally of our governor, and our governor has been posturing for the last couple of years, presenting himself as possibly a national candidate. On the Republican side, the Twin Cities are going to host the Republican National Convention next summer, and my God, think how that looks now to the beautiful Twin Cities when we have a bridge collapsing into the Mississippi River and people dying for a bridge that was found, as I say again, structurally deficient, a 50% rating, which means, as the Commissioner of Transport or the Secretary of Transportation just said there, that it ought to be considered for replacement. Where are the public officials erring on the side of public safety instead of just trying to get by as long as they can and spending as little as possible? This governor vetoed a 5-cent increase in the state gas tax last spring, the first gas tax increase the state had ever passed in more than 20 years. He vetoed it. Millions are not going into road repair and construction. Around the country, we know the infrastructure is in trouble, and bridges and systems and highways and other public systems are failing, and I think the governments need to address this and face up to it and not just go around. How can you say a 50% rating and a structural deficiency with 140,000 vehicles a day doesn't mean something should be done?
Was the repair or replacement of that bridge one of the priorities in that gas tax measure?
Well, I don't believe it was even mentioned. I don't think that the gas tax, if it had passed, would have prevented this bridge from falling, because we are years behind the curve on this stuff. And I tell you, if the Secretary of Transportation thinks it's going to make people in this country feel better to tell us that there are thousands of bridges in that same condition as the one that collapsed and killed people yesterday, she is making a serious error, I believe, because I think that people want to know. They want assurances when they drive their minivans full of their kids strapped into their car seats across a river in this country that the bridge they're riding on is safe.
Nick Coleman, again, a columnist for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. You said nobody had known about this. It's my understanding that there were reports today that a couple of state studies were also done showing that there were problems, fatigue details in the floor truss system. That seems to mean the primary load-carrying part of the bridge superstructure. But it was said that nothing had cracked, that, in fact, there wasn't any immediate need for repair or replacement.
We don't know what the upshot of that was. It also recommended that these inspections be made every 6 months. We don't know, I don't believe, yet when the last one was made. But the point would be, I think, if you had signs up on the road that said, caution, bridge ahead, only 50% rating, I think, you know, a lot of people would not be taking these bridges.
Nick Coleman again, a columnist for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Now, Stephen Kass is editor at Discover, that, of course, a science magazine. And Stephen Kass, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
What can you tell us more broadly about the infrastructure issue nationwide?
Well, I think you have to understand that most of America's infrastructure really got built out very heavily in the 20th century, you know, after the great post-war boom. And even earlier than that. And I think what a lot of municipalities are facing, really for the first time in their history, is the problem of aging infrastructure, of having to go back and look at how these older bridges and buildings are really holding up. And here in New York, we recently had a steam pipe explosion where a 100-year-old steam pipe blew up. So I think this is going to become more and more of a problem to other municipalities around the country that, you know, how do we monitor our older infrastructure? How do we model it so we don't have to dig up a road if we don't really have to? Because, you know, it's okay to complain about, you know, oh, there's cracks, we can't do that. But the fact is, most buildings are not perfect, and so it's a really difficult thing to do to make that call is, when do I go to all the public expense of rebuilding a bridge or tearing something down, and when is it okay to let that aging infrastructure go on for another little bit?
We just heard that the governor of Minnesota vetoed a 5-cent increase in the gasoline tax. He said it had been a long, long time since the legislature had approved a gasoline tax increase or any other kind of tax increase, and that's true nationwide too, isn't it? It's very difficult to get people to approve the kind of money it would take to really make these sorts of repairs.
Yes, and I think it's a terrible tragedy that it does take these kind of tragedies to really drive safety improvements. Historically, it's always, you know, a ship sinking or a horrible fire that has really, you know, lit the fire and given the political cover to legislators to, you know, raise taxes and pay for certain safety regimes or inspections. And I hope that, you know, if some good comes out of this tragedy, that it may provoke a look at and a more willingness to pay for in inspections worldwide. I think I'm really putting my faith in the National Transportation Safety Board, who are going to be going over this with a fine-tooth comb. And I think we really should be looking very carefully at their recommendations. They're an amazing organization. The only problem is that sometimes when they investigate an accident, their recommendations don't get acted upon. So I think we should look very carefully what the NTSB has to say and really think about funding what recommendations they do make.
Speaking of the NTSB, here's an interesting comment from Mark Rosenker, who's head of the National Transportation Safety Board. He said it's going to take time, of course, to figure out what went wrong.
First thing we must do is recover the pieces. And after we recover these pieces of the bridge, we will begin actually trying to reassemble them, not in a way where it's actually standing, but kind of in a jigsaw puzzle way, flat, so we can look at the various parts of this bridge and understand what made it fall down last night.
Again, the head of the National Transportation Safety Board, and Nick Coleman, back to you, our columnist with the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Is this a process, do you think, that people in the Minneapolis are going to be watching fairly closely? It sounds as if they're going to have to actually reassemble this structure.
Well, I think we're going to have to reassemble even more than that. We're going to have to reassemble our entire notion of what we expect from government and how we pay for it, how we support it. It's very ironic that this very evening we were supposed to have the groundbreaking for a new $500 million publicly financed stadium for the Minnesota Twins, a private corporation owned by one of the wealthiest people in this country. That groundbreaking had to be postponed because, of course, it would be very unseemly to be celebrating to spending $500 million on of public money on a private venture when our bridges are falling down. So I don't think you can overestimate the likelihood here of a very fierce and very angry debate about how we are paying for financing and our public infrastructure and public systems that we expect and deserve from government. And also, I think the debate will become a philosophical one over what kind of a country we want to be in. I would imagine, you know, we heard yesterday here in the Twin Cities that this was being reported all over the world. And I'm sure that in the developed countries of the world, or even in the undeveloped ones, people are looking at this. How can this happen in the United States? This was not a tornado. This is not a flood or a fire. This is not terrorism or deliberate destruction. This is collapse. For what good reason? I think we have the right to expect better.
Stephen Kass, back to you, editor at Discover. Do you agree that this is going to set off a nationwide debate, or do you think this is liable to be one of those things that's forgotten about as soon as the television cameras are tuned at the next event?
I think in terms of the public conscience, it probably, unfortunately, will be the latter. I mean, we've always seen these major tragedies, and this is not the first bridge in the United States to collapse. I mean, there have been very famous cases of bridges going down before. What generally tends to happen, though, is that there is a more measured analysis. You know, people really try and learn from these failures, and they, you know, sometimes unexpected things happen, and then they try and really learn, well, what was different about this bridge? Why did this bridge fail? Is there anything similar in other bridges like this? And maybe we need to step back and reassess our arrangements. And these things tend to get reflected in later years as, you know, federal guidelines are tightened up. For instance, the type of construction that bridge was the design of that bridge would not be okay today, because even, I think, 3 years after that bridge was built, a new set of guidelines came in that demanded much more structural redundancy in the bridge. And I think that's a movement you'll see all over what our current infrastructure is, building in more structural redundancy. Oh, structural redundancy, or lack thereof, is also what caused the Oklahoma building bombing to be so devastating, because that building didn't have any structural redundancy. So I think you'll see engineers paying attention to this. I think you'll see regulators paying attention to this. And I think we'll see people learning from this and really making an emphasis on building structural redundancy into their structures, so that even if you get a major failure or somebody really botches up a weld, that, you know, there's some failure, but you don't have lost lives, or you have as few lost lives as possible.
Nick Noel-Coleman, at one point I saw a report that initially the area around the bridge, I suppose on the banks, had been roped off as a crime scene. What's the significance of that?
Well, I think it's just merely being very cautious to, A, keep people away from a very dangerous and shifting area where things may still collapse further, and B, so that they don't interfere with the ongoing efforts to recover or discover anybody trapped still in the wreckage. If I could respond just briefly to your other guests'
quickly, if you
comments,
will.
I don't, you know, the last bridge collapse in this country that I'm aware of was about 25 years ago. It had to do with structural design problems. This is not a structural design problem. This is a lack of maintenance problem. This is a neglect problem, and that is very different.
Okay, and of course there was the collapse of a freeway overpass under construction in Northern California just a few days ago. Thank you both. Nick Coleman, columnist, Minneapolis Star Tribune, and Stephen Kass at Discover Magazine, and our other guests as well. Next up on To the Point, congressional ethics reform. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Well, I'll be back with To the Point. After a series of scandals led to fines and imprisonment of lobbyists and members of Congress last year, the new Democratic majority promised reform. This week, after closed-door debates and compromises, the House passed an ethics bill by a vote of 411-8. The Senate will take it up next. Provisions include bans on gifts and limitations on travel provided by lobbyists, disclosure of earmarks, and reporting by lobbyists who raise $15,000 or more by bundling smaller donations from various different people. Melanie Sloan is executive director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, obviously a watchdog group in this area. Melanie Sloan, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think of this bill?
I think it has some good provisions that are a positive first step, but I'm concerned about the lack of enforcement of these provisions. So much of what was passed this year was in response to the Jack Abramoff scandal, which he, a former lobbyist, has now been convicted, and members of Congress have been wrapped up in that. The problem is, though, that a lot of the things that happened in the Abramoff scandal were already against the rules. The problem was there wasn't any enforcement of the rules, and this bill doesn't change that.
What kind of enforcement would you hope for?
I'd hope to see the creation of an Office of Public Integrity to overseen in the House and Senate, which would investigate misconduct by members of Congress. Here, there are new penalties for lobbyists, and lobbyists are being forced to disclose if they've given, for example, an improper gift to a member of Congress, but there's no additional penalty for members of Congress who violate the rules.
So all the stress, then, is on the lobbyists?
Oh, yes. It's all on the lobbyists.
Let's talk about some specifics. For example, this bundling issue with a limit of $15,000. What's that about?
That's because there's been a big issue with there are campaign contribution limits, and the way people get around the campaign contribution limits is that lobbyists go to all the members, for example, of a company, and they get contributions from each of those people, and then they bundle them together and then give that bunch of money, the bundle of checks, to the member of Congress. And that is a way a lobbyist has a great deal more influence. If you are a heavy bundler, able to get huge amounts of contributions, you are more important to a member of Congress.
But if you bundled $14,999, you wouldn't have to report it.
That's right. And you also won't have to report it if you're not a registered lobbyist who bundles. So it's only lobbyists who bundle and then bundle over $15,000 worth of checks.
What about the earmark provisions?
The earmark provisions are a big improvement. There has been so much trouble, especially over the last 10 years, with members of Congress who stick in earmarks in the dead of night, all for the specific financial benefit of one particular individual or company. And this is something that we saw a lot of with the Duke Cunningham scandal. He's now in jail for 10 years for using his position in defense appropriations to give black budget earmarks, particularly those are the ones that are not ever visible to the public, making earmarks to companies in return for bribes. And hopefully this will cut down on members of Congress using their positions to earmark in return for things like campaign contributions.
What are the new provisions regarding earmarks?
The new provisions really only affect the Senate, not the House, and they require the majority leader to say that all the earmarks have been disclosed, and they're supposed to be disclosed on a website for 48 hours before there's an actual vote on a bill. So all earmarks should be listed, and they should list which member of Congress put them in.
Does so the lobbyists don't have to do this listing. The members of Congress do it?
Yes, this is something that the members have to do. The senators have to do.
I was going to say, how'd the House get exempted from it?
Well, I don't really know the answer to that. I just know that it's a provision that's been put in the Senate side and not in the House side.
Melanie Sloan with Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. One of the people who is most involved in the exposure of Randy Duke Cunningham, now serving a long prison term, former congressman from California, is Jerry Kammer. He's a reporter in the D.C. Bureau of Copley News Service. His reporting actually led to the probe of Mr. Cunningham. He's also co-author of The Wrong Stuff, The Extraordinary Saga of Randy Duke Cunningham, the most corrupt congressman ever caught. Jerry Kammer, good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren. Good to be back.
What about this? It doesn't apply to the House, so it would suggest then that if another Duke Cunningham came along, perhaps he could do the same thing.
I think if anyone, any member of Congress, particularly an appropriator, a member of the Appropriations Committees, is determined to be corrupt, this legislation would not stop it. But certainly it will narrow the playing field on which they could operate. I think a lot of it comes down to the integrity of the committee process and what the chairman and ranking member of the committee of the Appropriations Committee allow. But clearly, I think what we have in this legislation is an improvement.
I should say that as we are speaking, it's been reported by the Associated Press that the Senate has passed the ethics bill by 83-14. We don't know the details of that, but it now will presumably become law. Jerry Kammer, do you know how it is that the House was exempted from these reporting requirements for the earmarks?
Well, the House writes its own rules. I mean, that is one of the great benefits of being a member of Congress. You're part of basically a gentleman's club that writes its rules, many of which in the long view are directed at ensuring their incumbency, and earmarks have been a great way to do that. And I think many members are being dragged quite reluctantly into earmark reform and are trying to resist. For example, we had a proposal originally that would have barred members of Congress for 2 years from lobbying once they left Congress. Well, that was unacceptable to members of the House. They cut it back to the current figure, which is 1 year, which to me begs the question, for whom are they working while they're in Congress? Are they just lining up their next jobs down on K Street?
Jerry Kammer, once again, with the Copley News Service in Washington. We'll come back to him as well as Melanie Sloan. But let's get a lobbyist into this conversation. Wright Andrews is a partner with Butera and Andrews. That's a lobbying firm in Washington. He's former president of the American League of Lobbyists and co-wrote their code of ethics. Wright Andrews, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be on.
What about it? Is this going to make much of a difference?
Well, I certainly think it will make some difference. It is a step in the right direction. It does hit on some areas. That said, I think that your first speaker mentioned the lack of enforcement. That's certainly an issue there. If you don't have an independent enforcement body that's really focusing on this, that can be a problem. But, you know, I don't think most of the provisions here with respect to lobbyists are going to cause lobbyists any serious problem or objection. Lobbyists, and certainly the American League of Lobbyists, which I had, was president of earlier, has always been in favor of better disclosure, and this does bring some better disclosure. I don't think, however, that the bundling limitations here are going to have that great a negative impact on the lobbyist, but I think it should probably have a little more impact than it's going to.
You say that lobbyists favor disclosure. I think there's an assumption that is made by a lot of people that it's the lobbyists that want to hide their influence, not from their clients, obviously, but from the general public. Explain why it is that you say lobbyists, in fact, favor disclosure.
Well, I say some lobbyists in the American League of Lobbyists have always been supportive of any reasonable disclosure because, lobbyists get tired of the public thinking that they are bad, they are doing evil. A lot of that comes from a lack of adequate public disclosure. I think one of my biggest concerns today is that the lobbyists are drawn more than ever before into the campaign finance process, and lobbyists are not simply bundling checks, but they do a great deal of aggressive fundraising. This is something that has become very important in much of the lobbying business, and we spend far too much time to be competitive, I guess, raising money for members of Congress, and I think that personally needs to be tightened up significantly.
And this bill, you think, with that $15,000 limit, that's not going to do that?
No, I don't think so at all. I think the $15,000 limit, the way they have in the last version of the bill that I looked at, which was a House pass version, they defined bundled contributions as something if you forwarded them to the committee, if the lobbyists forwarded a group of them, or if they were received and credited to some type of tally that the lobbyists, i.e. Wright Andrews, raised me 50 grand, whatever it might be. Well, I think you could get around those quite easily. And for many lobbyists who they will not mind having this listed, hey, it's good advertising is what some will say.
Wright Andrews, again, former president of the American League of Lobbyists, co-wrote the Code of Ethics for Lobbyists. Ken Gross is former head of enforcement for the Federal Election Commission. He's now head of the political law group at the law firm of Skadden, Arps, Slate, Marr, and Flom, one of the highest earning law firms in the United States. He testified about the ethics bill as it was being prepared. And Ken Gross, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Did you testify before both houses or just one?
There were no hearings before the Senate. I only testified in the one hearing they had on this bill, and that was before the House Subcommittee on Judiciary Subcommittee.
Just one public hearing on this bill, despite all the public attention paid to it.
Yes.
Did you testify in favor of some of the measures we've been talking about here?
I supported the bill, generally speaking. The qualms that I had with it had to do with the bundling provision, which we've talked about. Mm-hmm. I thought it was vague and ambiguous, although I was really testifying on the Senate bill before the House, because the House had yet put it down on paper. And I also supported the disclosure of grassroots lobbying, not a particularly popular provision in Washington, and that went down.
What is that? What does that mean?
Well, if you reach out to third parties, if you some of these campaigns are very sophisticated. Millions of dollars were spent on electronic communications and other communications with members of the public, members of organizations, employees of large companies and union members who are, for lack of better words, artificially stimulated to write their member a letter saying, or write them an email or somehow communicate with them on a piece of legislation. And many states require this. In fact, over half the states in some form have disclosure of grassroots lobbying. But in Washington, it's something that is not been favored and was knocked out of the bill. It was in a former bill, some of the older versions of the legislation, but was knocked out of the Senate bill before it went to the House. And while there has been some support, it never got enough currency to make it into either of these bills that passed this term.
In other words, as I understand it, then an unknowing voter gets a communication and doesn't really know the source of it.
The problem that the members have is that they get a flood of letters, say, from their constituents.
I see. It's the other way around then. Okay.
Right.
Got it.
And they don't know who stimulated these letters. Sometimes they do. Other times they have no idea.
Do the constituents know?
The constituents usually know where the communication is coming from. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not from the dark of night. It's some organization. And if it was just over the transom, presumably they wouldn't respond to it. Only the ones that, if they're a member of an organization or a company or a union, and then those are the situations where they may be responsive.
You testified once again, one of only four people who testified in that one hearing. Do you know, can you explain why it is that the House exempted itself from the provision having to do with earmarks?
Well, earmarks was not a subject of the judiciary jurisdiction, so it actually didn't even come up at that hearing. It was never subject to any hearing testimony, the issue of earmarks. There is a provision, however, a lot of these earmarks are even more subtle than I think we're describing. A lot of them get delivered in bills that are in conference. After the House passes a bill and the Senate passes a bill, they get what's called airdropped in into a conference committee when it was not part of the bill from the House or the Senate. It's a new provision, and this new law, as I understand it, which, as you just noted, just passed the Senate moments ago, will require the disclosure of those airdrops if they're new provisions, and any point of order can require a 60 vote on whether it can be included in the bill. So it does bring some sunshine to bills after they pass the House and the Senate, but I don't know about all the maneuvering behind the House rulemakings.
And when they are in those conference committees after they pass out, then they're not debated and amended after that, right? They have to vote either yes or no on them on the floor of both the House and the Senate.
That's right. Once they meet a conference compromise, it goes back to each chamber, and they basically have an up or down vote on it.
Ken Gross, once again, a former enforcement head at the Federal Election Commission, now with a prestigious law firm in Washington. We're going to continue this conversation and come back in a moment with all of our guests and hear more about the ethics reform now just passed by the Senate as well as the House. The Senate vote today, 83-14, while we have been on the air. I'll be right back with Which Way Ally.
For more information about To The Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To The Point.
Warman, only back with To the Point. Once again, talking about the ethics bill just passed by the Senate, 83-14, passed earlier this week by the House, 411-8. Let me go back to Melanie Sloan, the executive director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. One of the senators reportedly who voted for the bill today is Ted Stevens, the Republican from Alaska, has just had his house in Alaska searched by the FBI and the IRS. Does that suggest that the Republican administration has set the dogs on its own party members in an effort to try to clean up what's called the culture of corruption?
I think that's right. I think that the Justice Department has been seriously trying to clean up Congress for the past few years, and I think they've made it very clear that they're not going to tolerate corruption from Congress. Sadly, Congress is much more willing to tolerate corruption from its own members. They are loath to take each other to task for improper conduct. For example, we never saw the House Ethics Committee go after either investigate either Duke Cunningham or Bob Ney, and now there's no reason to believe that the Senate Ethics Committee will be investigating Ted Stevens. So they've certainly all basically taken this hands-off approach, and they leave it only to justice. And luckily, justice is taking a very aggressive position these days on congressional corruption.
Everybody is innocent until proven guilty. What is it that it appears they're investigating with regard to Senator Stevens?
The allegations against Senator Stevens are still a little vague, but it's a very serious situation regarding an Alaska oil company called Vico, which was building a renovation on Ted Stevens' Alaska home. And all of the bills for that renovation were going to Vico, which is not a home construction company. Senator Stevens alleges that he was paying those bills, but hard to understand how the bills were going to Vico in the first place. The former head of Vico, Bill Allen, and the president of it, Rick Smith, are both cooperating, as are many other people. And there have been statements from large numbers of people in the case saying that Vico was paying the bills. And Senator Stevens, in his position as one of the top, the longest-serving Republican in the Senate, one of the top Senate appropriators, has apparently been doing a lot of earmarking and offering other assistance to Vico, although exactly what the direct exchange is at this point is still unclear.
So is there any way of knowing whether anything that's involved in this case might be affected in any way by the ethics bill that's just been passed?
It is hard to know still at this point. It doesn't look like it will affect him. The only possibility would be that at some point this bill makes it against, it takes away pensions of members of Congress who have, who are convicted of crimes involving their office. But I think that will be for crimes that begin to be investigated after the passage of this bill. So I think Stevens will even avoid losing his pension if ever convicted.
Melanie Sloan at the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics. Jerry Kammer, back to you with the Washington Bureau of the Copley News Service, reported so much on the Randy Duke Cunningham case. What's your take on the Justice Department, the way it's operating? Or let me ask you a different question. What is your take on the Justice Department? Let's start there.
Well, taking up on what Melanie was saying about the failure of the Ethics Committee, we could also look at the failure of the Appropriations and Intelligence Committees on which Cunningham sat and through which he passed earmarks to those who bribed him. Earmarks were the currency with which he paid off bribes. The Appropriations Committee went under Republican control before the last election, declined to investigate its processes to see how they were abused by Duke Cunningham. When the Democrats took over, they have also declined. Mr. Obie, chairman of the committee, has not ordered an investigation. In the Intelligence Committee, it's the same thing in terms of release of a report that was done. Neither the Republicans nor the Democrats, now in control of that committee, want full disclosure, want transparency into how their processes were manipulated by Duke Cunningham. And so the question becomes, of course, how can we have any confidence that there will not be repeats of these things?
Another Republican, Bob Ney of Ohio, I just mentioned, and it's my understanding that he, as my recollection, I should say, that he, as well as Randy Duke Cunningham, pled guilty to very serious charges, if I'm not mistaken. So the evidence was very strong against them. Is that right?
There's no question that Duke Cunningham plundered the process. He himself, you know, pled guilty, and one of those alleged to have bribed him, Mitchell Wade, a defense contractor, has also entered a guilty plea. Others are awaiting trial.
So, Ken Gross, let me go back to you, former head of the Federal Election Commission, now practicing law in Los Angeles. You said you did testify in favor of this bill that just passed. But what about the responsibility of the houses of Congress to investigate themselves? And is there any prospect that they'll be willing to do that, even with these very dramatic cases that we've seen replicated again and again?
In the case of Cunningham and Abramoff, particularly Cunningham, is just good old-fashioned bribery. And that's been against the law and on the books for years. And we didn't need a new law to address that type of misconduct.
But what about an action by the Congress, as Jerry Kammer suggests, to look at its own procedures to see whether or not it could prevent this kind of activity? And incidentally, I just located you in Los Angeles, and of course you're in Washington. Go ahead.
Right. Thank you. I think that the some of these provisions regarding earmarking that have a bit more sunshine associated with them, they're not as strong as perhaps they should be on the House side because they don't apply to appropriations by federal agencies. But that, to me, was one of the most important aspects of this legislation, was to get that kind of activity out into the open. And at least it looks like it will happen at the conference stage, for preventing, good old-fashioned bribery where there has to be a quid pro quo. This bill does have some additional penalties in it, both civil and criminal, for misdisclosure of receipt of gifts or anything like that, even someone getting tickets to a Super Bowl or something like that. If you don't properly disclose that, not only is it a violation by the recipient, as it had been, but the donor is now, the lobbyist donor is also subject to criminal and civil penalties under this new law. So there is some teeth to this, and these are important laws. How aggressively they will be enforced remains to be seen. But the law as it is written reaches into areas that had not been, we have not seen legislation before.
But the question is, who is going to do the enforcing if there's no independent group?
The enforcement will have to be done by the U.S. Attorney's Office and the District of Columbia, both civil and criminal, unless, of course, there's a bribery case out in the jurisdiction where it may have occurred. But for violations of this lobby law and the gift law provisions will be here in the District of Columbia. The Ethics Committee doesn't really have jurisdiction over lobbyists. It can only censor its own members. So a real investigation will have to come from the U.S. Attorney's Office. Even if there isn't an Office of Public Integrity, as Melanie was talking about, which frankly is probably a dead issue. It's not. There is some looking at the enforcement mechanism, but there doesn't seem to be too much enthusiasm for a separate, independent investigative arm within the House or the Senate. But it will be up to the U.S. Attorney's Office. And this new bill requires public disclosure of referrals of violations or possible violations from the Senate to the U.S. Attorney, and they will have to report on cases that they pursue. They won't be identifying the cases, but the number of cases that are referred to the U.S. Attorney's Office and the number of cases that the U.S. Attorney pursues will have to be made public. Previously, it was done in a very stealthy way, and we couldn't even find out how many referrals that were being made.
Jerry Kammer, is that good news from the news reporting standpoint? Do you think that there will be more information available, and will it be easier to keep track of what's going on?
Well, we'd certainly like to know more about the ongoing investigation into the relationship between Jerry Lewis, former chairman of the Appropriations Committee when Duke Cunningham was plundering it, and a lobbyist by the name of Bill Lowry, a former congressman who became a lobbyist. And we have had confirmed indirectly that there is a federal criminal investigation out of Los Angeles into that relationship. And though I think the more we can know about what is being done in this regard by the Justice Department, the better, especially given the vacuum left by Congress.
Right, Andrews, back to you quickly, if you will, because we're running short of time. Former president of the American League of Lobbyists. Do lobbyists sort of resent it? Melanie Sloan suggested that this is more onerous against lobbyists than it is against members of Congress. Do your colleagues feel that the Congress and the Senate ought to take more responsibility for enforcing these things and more responsibility for their own conduct than they do.
Well, I really can't speak for all lobbyists. I'm sure that some do and some don't.
How do you feel?
Well, I think you ought to have a relatively level playing field with responsibility both on the part of the lobbyist and on the members.
Okay, members too. So you'd like to see more provisions of the sort that we've been talking about?
I personally don't have any problem with it. For example, we've been talking about the earmarking in the appropriations process, which is, you know, very good that that's disclosed. But people seem to be forgetting that an awful lot of provisions are put in an awful lot of bills for lobbyists, myself included. And I don't have a problem with disclosure in that context.
All right. Well, thank you all very much. Once again, the ethics bill passed the Senate as we were speaking, 83-14. It is now law. Wright Andrews with Butera and Andrews, former president of the American League of Lobbyists. Jerry Kammerer at the Washington Bureau of the Copley News Service. Ken Gross at Skadden, Arps, Slate, Marr, and Flom, formerly with the Federal Election Commission. And Melanie Sloan of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Today's program produced by Francis Anderton, Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, Vanessa Romo, and Karen Radziner. Our technical director is Mike Newport. For more information about To The Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To The Point. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.